So King Nriga, he left. So what did we learn from King Nriga's dealings? That there are... Okay.
God blessing of devotees.
Yeah, that's the most essential and deepest point. And that, but also he... That blessing, because people tend to say, oh, give me your blessings, and then I don't have to do anything. But actually, he took shelter of the gift. He did his part. Another thing from that part?
The blessings of the devotee are much more powerful and beneficial and important than even giving out in charity and limited.
Yeah. Unlimited cows.
Yes. Don't become attached to pious activities.
Matali, behind you.
Yeah, I was going to say basically the same thing. That if you, no matter how perfectly you try to perform pious activities, there will always be some flaw, and that the result somehow will be tainted. You won't really get what you
want. Yeah. And the contrast, and look at the example. Contrast and compare. This is a good question for his Nriga's situation with Banasura. Now Banasura was a suric by nature and just attempting to get power for himself. He's a daitya, and the king was very pious by nature. So they were completely different, and they were headed, in one sense, in different directions. But they had one thing in common. They had the blessings and the favor of a great devotee. In the case of Banasura, it was Lord Shiva, and in the case of King Nriga, it was just something that he had done to this to a great devotee. He had provided something from him out of his charitable disposition. And the results in both cases were exalted. So we could say that it doesn't make a difference in one sense of the externals of one's position. How did Banasura, do you remember how Banasura pleased Lord Shiva?
By playing
just play with the drums. He was playing the drum to accompany Lord Shiva's dancing at the Tandava, at the dissolution dance. So it was just something that he was doing in Lord, but he was a devotee of Lord Shiva, and Vaishnavanam Yata Shambhu, who was a great devotee, and such, it saved his life. And similarly, it saved the life of King Nriga, practically speaking, and awarded him a glorious eternal life, because that wasn't the end of it. Let's see if I remember correctly. Yeah, he was a devotee by the end. And he was wondering how humble he was. He was wondering, how is it possible that I've in my condition, in my terrible, miserable consciousness, have actually had direct darshan of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So such humility had taken birth in his heart, and that is the positive that can come from suffering. It's not that suffering in and of itself can bring one to bhakti, but if we go through the doorway of humility, then we can surrender. So he actually became humble. And if we notice that the potency of an exalted Vaishnava is so great in the case of Banasura, that he never became humble, practically speaking, until Lord Shiva, he was one arm after the other, or two at a time, or whatever, he was cutting off his arms. So that means he kept on shooting. Two arms, so he had 998 left, and then he still was shooting, and then two more, and then he was still shooting, and then two more, and then he was still shooting, and two more, he was still shooting, and two more, he was still shooting. So how long it took the intervention, the direct intervention of the devotee, Lord Shiva and his very humble and powerful prayers before Banasura actually became humble, and at the end he did offer his obeisances and surrender, and he participated in the bringing of Ushana Niruddha back to Dwarka. So very mysterious, the ways of the dealings of the material world and the dealings of, and look in the previous chapters with the Shaimataka jewel, how this Satyajit, he had the jewel and he ended up being killed because of not giving it to Krishna. And then Akura had the jewel and he ended up being easily forgiven by Krishna because one was a devotee and one wasn't a devotee. This, we should look at the dealings between Krishna and his devotees and let that inspire us that yes, I can also become a devotee. I should actually become a devotee. This is my desire. I want to actually surrender to and serve Krishna with a full heart, with great love, with great devotion. And then we can go back to the opening chapters of the 10th canto and see how the Brijbasis, the nature of their loving service to Krishna. There is no thought of anything but Krishna. There is no self-interest, swata. There's no separate interest other than the pleasure of Krishna. And it's all spontaneous. And that's the specific quality of the love of the Brajavasis, that it's ragatmika bhav. It's all on the spontaneous platform. They love him, and therefore that is what impels their activities. It is just a spontaneous attraction for Krishna. And they don't know anything else or anyone else other than trying to please Krishna. It's just the nature of their love. Was that a hand raised with a question?
I was just thinking because I mentioned to you yesterday.
But that's still available too, that Prabhupada's speaking that too. That's available for you. Have you heard it recently?
Not recently.
Why don't you hear it? And that actually, it's in the Bhagavatam itself, that Lord Shiva felt like he was like his son. And also, he did call him a fool. Muda, he called him. But not in an inimical way. Obviously, it wasn't inimical because his prayers are what he came out just to because of his attachment to Manasura. So let's continue. And Krishna willing, we shall finish this chapter. Now this, the remainder of the chapter has basically one topic, but my reading of it, I'm considering the first part of the chapter, which very much glorifies the potency of Vaishnava association, and even if it's just for a moment, lava matra. And especially of some service done. In the light of that first chapter, which was the cause of King Nriga's success, how interesting it is that all his giving of charity wasn't truly the cause of his true success. It was because of the discrepancy in it, the necessary discrepancy. Was that a raised hand?
Yeah.
This happens in other places too, with the Vidyadhara. He also asked to return. So that's practically the first thing that he does in this. Yes, he's not qualified to participate in Krishna's Leela, clearly. He's not fully qualified. But I'm just looking for one. He was still under his karma, and he had to work through it, but his situation was somewhat different now because he had seen the Lord. Certainly that was going to deeply affect him even more. But what does he desire? He desires, wherever I live, O Master, may my mind always take shelter of your feet. So that was actually his desire, and that would eventually bring him to the more ultimate situation. Now, there's no mention here. I thought I had seen it, but incorrectly. There's no mention of an ultimate result for him, and nor is there a mention of the ultimate result for the Vidyadhara, who also desired similarly. But yeah, he has to mature. He's not qualified to stay. The Vidyadhara was in the Vrindavan area. He wasn't qualified to stay in Vrindavan. Lord Brahma's not qualified to stay in Vrindavan. Indra's not qualified to stay in Vrindavan. And similarly, he's not qualified. Nariga isn't qualified at this point to stay in Krishna's association in his Dwarka Leela. Let me just see if Prabhupada mentions. I thought I had seen it. Something about ultimate result. Excuse me for a moment. There's some here. Before entering the heavenly planets, King Nariga circumambulated the Lord, touched his helmet to the Lord's lotus feet, and bowed before him. Seeing the aeroplane from the heavenly planets present before him, he was given permission by the Lord to board it. After the departure of King Nariga, Lord Krishna expressed his appreciation for the king's devotion. His appreciation for the king's devotion to the brahmanas, as well as his charitable disposition and his performance of Vedic rituals. Therefore, it is recommended that if one cannot directly become a devotee of the Lord, one should follow the Vedic principles of life. This will enable him one day to see the Lord by being promoted either directly to the spiritual kingdom or indirectly to the heavenly kingdom, where his hope of being transferred to the spiritual planet. That doesn't directly speak about that. But since his desire was like that, he had to, seems like he had to fulfill his material fate to some degree, and then he would achieve more intimate association with the Lord. That's what I would say, but I didn't see anything directly about that. Do you want to comment or ask? That's the general understanding. That's the general understanding of piety. But we see that the demigod's desire in the Bhagavatam, it's described that the demigod's desire to take birth on earth during Kali Yuga because the special dispensation of suffering and anxiety in Kali Yuga causes one to take shelter of the holy names. The problem about being a demigod isn't that there's no facility for devotional service. That's not the problem, because Lord Vamandev is worshipped, for example, as Indra's older brother, younger brother. But the problem on the heavenly planets is not that there's not facility, it's that the mentality of a living entity tends to go towards enjoyment. So rather than lack of any possibility, because devotion, there's no situation in which one can't perform devotional service within. It's not limited by time and space. But one's desire to serve is seduced by that strong tendency to enjoy. And we see in the example of Gop Kumar in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita that he kept going. It depends on our situation in the material world, depends on our desires. So because his desire was strong, his prayer was strong, what he wanted was strong, just to whatever situation he was in, to keep his mind on the lotus feet of the Lord, then the ultimate result is going to be perfect. We're going to have to separate you two.
I'm going to
Okay, let's continue. So Krishna's going to speak about the Brahmins here, because there's a lesson on the Karmakanda platform, on the Vanashrama platform as well as what we've been mostly speaking about. So, text 31. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, the son of Devaki, who is especially devoted to the Brahmanas and who embodies the essence of religion, then spoke to his personal associates and thus instructed the royal class in general. So what Krishna is going to do is speak about the relationship between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, because he's speaking to the royal order and to his... In effect, practically speaking, he's instructing the royal order as he's instructing his sons. So it's essential in the Vanashrama system that the Brahmins are respected by the royal order. Why? Because the Kshatriyas of the royal order, they have power. They have all the power. But power tends to corrupt. And it tends to, as the history of the world has so much shown in Kali Yuga, it tends to lead one to want to accumulate power. And this later on, but quite soon actually, we're going to read the prayers of the kings after they were freed from Jarasandha, and their prayers of what it is like to be a king. They describe it. To have that kind of power really affects one's consciousness. So, and one wants to accumulate power, and one is always afraid of losing power. And one's always afraid of enemies and making alliances, etc., etc., and getting enamored by the wealth and the facilities for sensual enjoyment that being a king allows. So what is the check and the balance on that in the Vanashrama system? It's the Brahmins and the kings. The royal order for the system to work has to be subservient to the Brahmins. And what are the Brahmins? What is their function? To provide a direction for society, an ultimate reference point, that the purpose of life isn't to accumulate power. The purpose of life is spiritual. And their business is to know Shastra, just like the business of the Kshatriya is to know weaponry and diplomacy and how to rule. The business of the Brahmins is to know Shastra and to be pure of heart and be focused on what the purpose of life is. So the submission of the Kshatriyas to the Brahmins, because the Brahmins don't have the physical power to control the Kshatriyas, it allows the society to be led in a or the spiritual purpose of society is maintained. So this relationship of the Brahmins to the Kshatriyas and the Kshatriyas to the Brahmins, that the Brahmins have to remain free from material ambition and not be threats, to just be advisors to the Kshatriyas, that the Kshatriyas rule, and the Kshatriyas have to rule according to the direction of the Brahmins. So to keep the sanctity of the relationship of power, spiritual power and spiritual knowledge to material power, and let the spiritual power, spiritual knowledge, which means the Vedic knowledge, which means the Supreme Lord's direction and desire, guide the material power of society, this is essential. So as a part of this, Krishna is going to speak to make sure that the Kshatriyas, the royal order, know their relationship with the Brahmins. Krishna is going to speak here. How indigestible is the property of a Brahmin, even when enjoyed just slightly by one more potent than fire? What then to speak of kings who try to enjoy it, presuming themselves lords? We'll read some of the purports after, just to give us a feel for the whole flow of this. I do not consider halahala to be real poison because it has an antidote. But a Brahmin's property, when stolen, can truly be called poison, for it has no antidote in this world. So clearly this reflects back on the first pastime where King Riga, on the most basic level, received so much difficulty because of his inadvertently taking the property of a Brahmin. So very, very simple, very frightening. The pastime itself was frightening because even when one is trying to please the Brahmins, if one makes a mistake in his charity, one can get disastrous results. What to speak of consciously stealing a Brahmin's property, which was far from what Nriga did. So if Nriga got the result of being a lizard for a mistake that wasn't even a mistake, practically speaking, what happens if one actually steals it? There's no antidote for this poison. Poison kills only the person who ingests it. And an ordinary fire may be extinguished with water, but the fire generated from the kindling wood of a Brahmin's property burns the thief's entire family down to the root. If a person enjoys a Brahmin's property without receiving due permission, that property destroys three generations of his family. But if he takes it by force, or gets the government or other outsiders to help him usurp it, then 10 generations of his ancestors and 10 generations of his descendants are all destroyed. Members of the royal order, blinded by royal opulence because wealth and power tend to blind us. Therefore, for householders, the instruction is to give charity, so to overcome the blindness. That's the duty, the prime duty of a household is charitable, being charitable, dhanam. So because wealth and power tends to blind one, opulences, members of the royal order, blinded by royal opulence, fail to foresee their own downfall. Childishly hankering to enjoy a Brahmin's property, they're actually hankering to go to hell. So what famous Bhagavatam story? The Kshatriyas are destroyed by taking the property of a Brahmana? Pasara. For as many years as there are particles of dust touched by the tears of generous Brahmanas who have dependent families and whose property is stolen, uncontrolled kings who usurp a Brahmin's property are cooked, along with their royal families, in the hell known as Kumbhipaka. As many years touched by the tears. Whether it be his own gift or someone else's, a person who steals a Brahmin's property will take birth as a worm in feces, stool, for 60,000 years. I do not desire Brahmana's wealth. Those who lust after it become short-lived and are defeated. They lose their kingdoms and become snakes who trouble others. My dear followers, never treat a learned Brahmin harshly, even if he has sinned, even if he attacks you physically or repeatedly curses you. Always continue to offer him obeisances. Just as I always carefully bow down to Brahmanas, so all of you should likewise bow down to them. I will punish anyone who acts otherwise. When a Brahmin's property is stolen, even unknowingly, it certainly causes the person who takes it to fall down, just as the Brahmana's cow did to Nriga. So there, this part clearly reflects on Krishna's affectionate dealings. Namo Brahmanya Devaya. Krishna is so affectionate to the Brahmanas. There's that wonderful pastime when Krishna went out early one morning with Balaram, and he was playing with the boys, and he was playing. He was still a very young boy at that time. They were playing near the Yamuna, and then in Gokul, and then Mother Yasoda was cooking, so she asked Rohini, to call Krishna to return home, because Krishna was always playful and restless and running out. So Rohini called and Krishna didn't come back. The boys wouldn't let him because the boys are playing. That's what boys like to do. So they were threatening, if you go now, we're not going to play with you anymore. This is the ultimate weapon of a boy. We're not going to be your friend anymore. We're not going to play you. And these things were going on with Krishna. Sometimes Krishna would steal the boys' lunch baskets and the boys would cry. And sometimes the boys would steal Krishna's food and Krishna would cry. Krishna would cry because Krishna's consciousness, due to the love, he was so controlled by the love of his friends that his consciousness became like a young boy's consciousness. And he would forget, mudhata, he would forget his position as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, practically speaking. Of course, Krishna's consciousness is not possible for us to understand. But yet that would happen. So Mother Rohini came back and said Krishna wouldn't come, and it was getting late. So Mother Yasoda herself went out and she began to call Krishna. And she did it very, very, very carefully. Of course, everything was done with love. And she did it very carefully. Krishna was by the Yamuna. And she said, "Oh, Krishna, come back. Nanda Maharaj, your father, he won't take prasadam unless you're there. And he's waiting." So Krishna had to. His attention got caught by that. And then Mother Yasoda was slowly walking forward towards Krishna. "And Krishna, today is your birthday." And Krishna turned around. "Oh, yes, and today you come back, it's your birthday." And she was walking closer and closer. "And today you're going to give, you have to give charity to the Brahmins." And she was walking closer and closer to Krishna. And Krishna was turning, because Krishna, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur said, even from his earliest ages, was fond of giving charity to the Brahmins. This is Krishna's nature. So then she said, "Yes, it's your birthday." And Mother Yasoda was lying. It wasn't Krishna's birthday. So do we chastise Mother Yasoda for lying? No, everything was done with full bhakti. Again, the same point. Spontaneously generated lies from her love from Krishna. So as she was saying, "Yes, and you can give this in charity," and she got closer, then kap! She had caught him, because she was afraid if she started chastising him that he would run away, because Krishna was restless and naughty. And then she said, "Krishna, why have you been so, you know, are you a street boy? Look at you, you're covered with dust. Come on, let's go back." She already was holding him, so he couldn't do anything. And then Mother Yasoda, even though it wasn't Krishna's birthday, she performed a beautiful ceremony and let Krishna give charity. But Krishna, from the very beginning of his manifestation on earth, he loved to give charity to the brahmanas. So the final verse is, "Having thus instructed the residents of Dwarka, Lord Mukunda, purifier of all the worlds, entered his palace." So we'll, if we have a bit of time, we'll read some of the purports here, because the Brahmins were so dear to Krishna, because they were, from the point of view of the Brahmins, Brahmins were dear to Krishna because Krishna is dear to the Brahmins, and the whole society is resting on Brahminical knowledge of Shastra, giving a direction to society. And the history of Kali Yuga, beginning as the first canto of the Bhagavatam describes, with the cursing of Maharaj Prickett by Sringi, shows the degradation of Kali Yuga, and how as soon as the Brahmins lose their culture, they have power even. As Sringi had power, his curse was effective. But he didn't have culture. Culture means vanashrama culture. Culture means understanding the importance of the relationship, the inviolatable relationship between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. So by that loss of culture, This is specifically by the breaking in the relationship of Sringi with the Kshatriya king. Because of that, then Kali entered. And because of loss of culture, gradually the Brahmins began exploiting. And then the Kshatriyas thought, how can they exploit us? We have the armies, we have the power, what can they do? So they took power and they began exploiting, because the history of Kali Yuga is the history of exploitation, the increase of selfishness. And selfishness brings no one happiness. And this is the irony. The irony is, the more I act for me, the less happy me becomes. And everyone knows this, that it is more pleasant to give than to receive. Everyone knows this. Everyone knows the pleasure of giving and giving of oneself on every level, on any level. But yet, Kali Yuga, because of the increase in dissatisfaction within everyone's heart, everyone responds to that, because of no spiritual knowledge, responds to that by becoming more and more selfish. The problem is, I'm not getting enough for me. And the result of that is more dissatisfaction and more selfishness. So Brahminical culture and Srila Prabhupada carried on the wish of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur and Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur, of wishing to establish a God-centered Varnashrama system, so that society would have a true goal and not just base everything on economic development. And the Kshatriyas, as Kali Yuga progressed, started exploiting more, and then the Vaishyas thought, why should we let them have all the pleasure? So they took over, and the Kshatriyas became weak, and the Vaishyas became strong, and then finally the Vaishyas were exploiting, and then the Sudras take over, because why should we do all the work and they gain the money? And then you get the communistic type of philosophies and practices. So it's all just Kali Yuga. But I would like to refer to a very interesting section of the Bhagavatam in the third canto, in the 16th chapter, after the four Kumaras go to Vaikuntha, because there the Brahmins are very much glorified. But as we are pointing out in the first part of this chapter, the part about Nriga, the cause of his success was the blessings of a Vaishnava, which means the topmost Brahmana, because Brahmanas can be on different levels of consciousness, and we dutifully, in deference to Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, speak of Brahmanas not just by birth. This is also discussed in the Mahabharata and in the Manusamhita. That is, in Kali Yuga, everyone starts off as sujits, and it's so obvious too. It's so obvious that it's the qualities of a Brahmana where they are manifest that give the benefit of having Brahmanas in society. Obviously, it's obvious, as Prabhupada would say, to be born in the family of a high court judge doesn't necessarily make one a high court judge. It gives one some impetus in life. It gives one a particular tendency, perhaps. It gives one a chance, a good chance to become a judge. But it doesn't necessarily, if one doesn't develop the proper qualities and qualifications, then one can't be considered a judge. One can be respected a little bit, but one is certainly not a judge. You're respected because you're the son of the judge. So similarly, it's because Prabhupada had to fight this battle, and we're not so aware of it so much at this point, and it's not as consequential as it was during Srila Prabhupada's time. I want to speak of the time of Srila Bhakti Sananta Saraswati Thakur. He was such a revolutionary, and it was a war for him. It was a real war against a very constricted society that wouldn't allow, that was constricted in its casteism, not allowing and constricting the actual purpose of Varnashrama. So he fought this war, and he was against the hypocrisy of it, and it was very extreme actually, and it was such an issue. So we're not so aware of it, but dutifully, in honor of their great battles, and based on that, on their war that they fought with great power and great shastric evidence, it's based on their austerities that we're able to do what we do in the Krishna consciousness movement, just based on what they've done. We couldn't have the facilities that we do have to practice Krishna consciousness without the hard work and the fighting that they did to establish it. So in gratitude we mention that it is Brahman by quality. And then even then there are different levels of Brahmins. But the topmost Brahman, situated in the mode of goodness fully, is the one who is a Brahman Vaishnava. So that is indicated in the comments of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, that this actually was, it clearly was the great saving grace of King Riga. It was the blessing of a great devotee. And all the other benefits he got from the Brahmins, they were dangerous, that path of just trying to give charity to the Brahmins. It was dangerous, and not only that, after he had to reap that piety, and therefore he went off to the heavenly kingdom in a celestial airplane. But what saved him, so that point was also made, either in the body of a lizard or the body of a demigod. Do you remember that point? Both are not favorable for Krishna consciousness. But what is favorable is the association, the blessing, the service of the Vaishnavas. That's the most favorable thing. That's the topmost favorable thing. And the result of that, which should be cultivated, and knowing what the essence actually is, the result of that is the absorption, remembrance, absorption, the thinking, the taking shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. There's nothing. That is the result of everything. That our relationship with Krishna becomes enlivened, it becomes invigorated, the fulfillment of the soul's consciousness. So that part about the Brahmins and the importance of Brahmins in society is spoken about by Krishna. But clearly also, as mentioned in the first part, if this is true for the Brahmins, how true it is for the topmost Brahmins, the ones who are servants, who are fully pure servants of the Supreme Brahman, who are pure, have no other desire other than the service of Krishna. They have the. How much are they the benefactors of society? And therefore, that's the positive side. How much are they are the benefactors of society? And see what Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, and Srila Prabhupada did for the world, giving it, speaking the truth, giving it actual direction. And who know? We don't know, just like at the time of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the Krishna consciousness movement had spread to a certain degree in a certain part of the world, and it was passed to very much to Srila Prabhupada, not only Srila Prabhupada, but to Srila Prabhupada, especially to spread it all over the world to some degree. But even how much more the Krishna consciousness has spread all throughout the world since Srila Prabhupada's time, and in India, it's so apparent. So where it's ultimately going to go, time tells, and we have our own little parts to play in this unfolding drama, so let us play it well. But the point being, playing it well means making our insignificant devotional offerings to the progress of the Krishna consciousness movement with no envy at another's offering, just mind our own business, basically know what our own service is, and do it with great devotion as an offering to Srila Prabhupada, to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and this great unfolding of the spreading of Krishna consciousness of the holy names of Krishna, spread, chanted all over the world. But as the part of Brahmins are spoken about here, we'll also mention something about the topmost Brahmins and how Krishna, because Krishna feels so close to the Brahmins, so how does he feel towards the topmost Brahmins, his devotees, the deepest, his devotees? So on one level, if we understand that, then what will be reflected through this second part of this chapter is, if it's so dangerous to offend and give trouble in any way and deal with and take the property of a Brahmin because of Krishna's natural affection to the Brahmins, how much more still it is dangerous and inappropriate to deal in this way with the property and the activities of a Vaishnava, especially a great Vaishnava. Let me just finish this. So first, I would just like to read about the four Kumaras, and after they curse Jayanvijay, but then they go before Krishna, and they are so overwhelmed by actually seeing Lord Narayan. And then Krishna's words, or Lord Narayan's words to the four Kumaras, are very special. This whole pastime is so wonderful. But his words in chapter 16, in the opening verses of chapter 16, are very special because he speaks in his Parokshavad very, very subtle way. And he says, he means what he doesn't say, but it's clear when we read the whole thing, but he says something so wonderful about how dear his devotees are to him. So it's also interesting how Sananda, one of the four Kumaras, is mentioned in the prayers of Nriga, if I remember correctly. He says that I'm seeing you, while even the great yogis such as Sananda don't easily have the ability to meditate. They only have the ability to meditate upon you in their purified hearts. But I'm seeing you face to face. So here the four Kumaras, including Sananda, have actually seen the Lord face to face. So they have just cursed Jayanvijay, and then Krishna speaks to them. Lord Narayan speaks to them and says, "These attendants of mine, Jayanvijay by name, have committed a great offense against you because of ignoring me, ignoring my desire. They are the gatekeepers, and you are great, powerful brahmanas. They are the original brahmanas born from Lord Brahma, primal sons of Lord Brahma. All great sages," and they were great sages too, and they were just recently converts to Vaishnavism from being Brahmavadis. He says, the Lord says, "I approve of the punishment that you who are devoted to me have meted out to them because they have offended you. To me, the Brahmana is the highest and most beloved personality. The disrespect shown by my attendants has actually been displayed by me because the doormen are my servitors. I take this to be an offense by myself. Therefore, I seek your forgiveness for the incident that has arisen." So the the Krishna's, he's placing himself. We have offended you. He's placing himself in identity one with his doorkeepers, his devotees. And he's saying, yes, you were proper in cursing them and punishing them, and it's because I've done something wrong, because my servants, they're my servants. They are mine. So he's saying one thing, but he's subtly saying something very different. And the proof of this will be right at the end. A wrong act committed by a servant leads people in general to blame his master, just as a spot of white leprosy on any part of the body pollutes all of the skin. Anyone in the entire world, even down to the chandal, who lives by cooking and eating the flesh of a dog, is immediately purified if he takes bath in hearing through the ear the glorification of my name, fame, etc. And now you have realized, you've just realized me now. You, O Kumaras, have become my devotees now. And these two, who you have properly cursed because they didn't allow you in, these two have been serving me for eternity, practically speaking. So now that you have realized me without a doubt, therefore I will not hesitate to lop off my own arm if its conduct is found hostile to you. Because now you're my devotees, and I'll do anything for my devotees. I'll even cut off my own arm if it proves itself to be pratikul against my devotees. And these devotees have done something and you've cursed them? So in his indirect way, because Krishna is such a wonderful teacher, he's allowing them to become, to realize things for themselves. Because if Krishna said, you curse them, and they were my dear devotees, then naturally the tendency will start to figure out, well, yeah, I cursed them, but you don't know what they did. He just explained the other side, and the defense mechanisms kick into place. But then if Krishna is dealing in such an expert way that it comes around to them and they realize it themselves, because I am the servitor of my devotees, it's because I serve my devotees, who you happen to have just cursed. My lotus feet have become so sacred that they immediately wipe out all sins. And I have acquired such a disposition that the goddess of fortune does not leave me, even though I have no attachment for her, and others praise her beauty and observe sacred vows to secure from her even a slight. So you brahmanas, you're so dear to me, and you have made my lotus feet. You've given them the sacredness that they have. And I do not enjoy the oblations offered by the sacrifices. In the sacrificial fire, which is one of my own mouths, with the same relish as I do the delicacies overflowing with ghee, which are offered to the mouths of the brahmanas who have dedicated to me the results of their activities and who are ever satisfied with my prasad. I am the master of the unobstructed internal energy, and the water of the Ganga is the remnant left after my feet are washed. That water sanctifies the three worlds along with Lord Shiva, who bears it upon his head. If I can take the dust to the feet of the Vaishnavas on my head, the vipras is the word actually in the Sanskrit, but Prabhupada in his purport is showing that the brahmanas or the Vaishnavas are actually the brahmanas, the topmost brahmanas. So he says, of the vipras or the brahmanas on my head, who will refuse to do the same? The brahmanas, the cows, and the defenseless creatures are my own body. And those whose faculty of judgment has been impaired by their own sin look upon these as distinct from me. They are just like furious serpents, which is just what happened to the Kumaras, actually. Seeing that the Lord's devotee was carrying out a will different from the Lord. And they are angrily torn apart by the bills of the vulture-like messengers of Yamaraj, the superintendent of sinful persons. On the other hand, they captivate my heart, who are gladdened in heart, and who, their lotus faces enlightened by nectarian smiles, respect the brahmanas, even though the brahmanas utter harsh words. So this is very similar to what Krishna said here to his sons. Just keep on offering obeisances to the brahmins. They look upon the brahmins as my own self. These are the ones who captivate my heart, and pacify them by praising them in loving words, even as a son would appease an angry father, or as I am pacifying you. These servants of mine, he says it again, these servants of mine, they are dear to me. These Vaishnavas of Vaikuntha, these servants of mine have transgressed against you, not knowing the mind of their master. I shall therefore deem it a favor done to me. Krishna's going to beg on their behalf. If you order that, although reaping the fruit of their transgression, they may return to my presence soon, and the time of their exile for my abode may expire before long. And then the words of Lord Brahma, who's narrating this. Even though the sages had been bitten by the serpent of anger, which was just described by Krishna Narayan, their souls were not satiated by hearing the Lord's lovely and illuminating words, which was like a series of Vedic hymns. The Lord's excellent speech was difficult to comprehend because of its momentous import and its most profound significance. The sages heard it with wide open ears. Usually we don't hear with our ears wide open because our ears don't have opening and closing. We hear, we look with our eyes wide open, but the sages were attentive, fully attentive to these wonderful words. They heard it with wide open ears and pondered it as well. They thought about, what is Lord Narayan telling us? But although hearing, they could not understand what he intended to do. As Prabhupada explains in the purport, they tried with wide open ears to understand the words from the lips of the Supreme Lord, but although his speech was very concise and meaningful, the sages could not completely comprehend what he was saying. They could not even comprehend the purport of the speech or what the Supreme Lord wanted to do, nor could they understand whether the Lord was angry with them or pleased with them. And actually, his own pastime was being fulfilled, but he was actually instructing them that they had made a mistake, and therefore they did understand it. So therefore, they understood that they had cursed these people who were dear to the Lord, and that was a mistake. And therefore, they understood it actually. And therefore, they conclude, whatever punishment you wish to award to those two innocent persons, the gatekeepers, or also to us, we shall accept without duplicity. We understand that we have cursed two faultless persons. So after they understood the word, the Lord's very tricky, indirect words. Okay, we'll end here. Thank you. Any questions or comments? So really, the devotees. So if the Lord's words in the end of that chapter 64 indicating the Brahmins, which he certainly was because of the Lord's affection to the Brahmins, how much more so do they indicate the highest of the Brahmins, the devotees? But it also says they were qualified.
Yeah,
he always came to call. But they got angry. They were petty. Okay. So is that a curse for Nirigya or a blessing ultimately? But you just don't judge them. That's how they acted, because that's how they acted. You know, why do people act the way they do? Is because that's how they act. It seems after being alive for 73 years, you give up trying to figure it out why people do what they do. You know, and then otherwise you'd come up to them, excuse me, my dear Brahmins, with a clipboard. You know, according to the Bhagavad Gita, you should be, and he even pleaded with them like that. You're merciful. The Brahmins are merciful. I've given this to you. Please be merciful to me. And they just, you could say, impelled by, because no one is completely pure, the modes don't completely purely manifest in this world, or impelled by Krishna's desire, or impelled by something or another, or you know, that's how they reacted, and they didn't act in a brahminical way. You know, if they would have given you the cows in charity, you would have said, okay, I'll take the 100,000 plus 10,000 and give plus interest, and then everyone would have been happy. But what to do? They didn't do that. I mean, yeah, why do they do? Why do people act the way they do? I mean, why didn't they just say, okay, all right, no big, just a small thing, just one cow, and you're so generous. Please, here, take as many back as you like. So we appreciate open-heartedness, don't we? Then how much we would have loved those brahmanas, oh, if they would have acted like that. So I find that when I pick up something like that, something sort of tweaks me. That shouldn't be the way things are. It's good to reflect that back upon ourselves and see if there's someone and some circumstance that we should also be more generous-hearted about and not be miserly-hearted about and not let the lower modes of material nature infect our natural and general tendencies to want to be good. So it's always good to let those... I found that with things disturb you about something in Shastra and Prabhupada's books, you look especially for there, and there's some special mercy in there for you. Not for you particularly, because everyone thought like that, I'm sure, but yeah, is there some circumstance that I should be more generous-hearted about? So we become more introspective in that way. Did you want to say something a long time ago?
Question.
Yes. I know the country.
Well, maybe there are more than one.
I don't think so.
You can travel, make sure, receive some donations, all the reactions.
For the society.
For the society and for the particular yatra, I know stealing is like poison and burning somebody and taking three generations, all what Lord Krishna just said. So, I would like you to comment. What's your answer?
Let me turn off the microphone and the tape recorder and we'll. Why get myself in trouble or more trouble? But my understanding is we take a principle, which is what you said, and then we always have to adjust the principle in a practical way. So if I was that group of devotees, I would take this principle into account when trying to make a decision on how to deal with some problem that's caused by a certain situation. Because obviously there's been a problem in that place. Yes? Okay, but you're specifically not talking about everywhere, we're talking about that particular place that made that particular ruling. I'm talking about the principle. That there was a problem there. I don't really know what the problem, I don't know any detail. I try to keep myself knowing as little as possible about what goes on in the world so I don't get, it's not my service anymore to save the world. I used to think it was, but there was a problem from the management point of view. So how to balance out the problems and the principles takes great wisdom, because we can't be just on principle, and you can't be just practical. So you have to be able to adjust the practical according to the principles. So you have to be very conscious of the principles. And then the adjustments according to practical reality have to be made according to the principles. Not that principles can't ever be adjusted, but they have to be. But practical reality should take into account what the principles are, so that those principles are honored as much as we possibly can. So if I were asked how to deal with this situation, I would take this part of the Bhagavatam and these things spoken by Lord Krishna himself and show those to the devotees in a somewhat neutral way and ask them and just express to them what you just told me, that how can we reconcile this kind of a practical activity with a practical method of dealing with a problem with an actual principle that Krishna holds very, very dear. And see how people react to it. Not see how people react, but listen. I wouldn't do it by an email, but next time you see some of the devotees who have those kind of really strong feelings about it, see what they say. Oh, excuse me, hear what they say. That was a pretty unpolitical answer. Didn't answer the question, huh?
The question on that one is, which one is stealing? They'd probably just say the person who's visiting is the person stealing from the yatra. So they both apply.
And we're all Brahmins and things like that. But therefore, you know, that you could also make an argument from that as... and which has caused lots of tension with the societies, how to apply vanashrama principles to the governance and the activities of ISKCON. And that one really gets you in trouble. If you talk about money, you get into trouble. And if you talk about vanashrama, what do we used to call it? The V word. No one would mention it. But how do that? It really takes wisdom, because wisdom it gives the balance. So if there's something that's a little too far on this side, it's going to cause some reaction on the other side. So what's a typical reaction that can be caused on that side? People who are preachers, who are powerful preachers, won't feel inclined to go there, not so much even because they don't want to give 50% of their income or the donations that they get, but because they don't want to be controlled in that way. And they don't want to be seen as criminals in that way, or thieves or something like that. So people might not want to come. So that could be, so the art, or what wisdom really does, it gets the balance between the principle and the practical. And it's very hard to do that. So I think I would think, actually, if you have a relationship with some of the devotees in that place, in that yatra, you know, to bring it to their attention, and how do you deal with things like this? How do you deal with the Shastric principle when it comes to a practical problem that you're having? Because if you don't deal with it in a wise way, you lose on another side. You gain what you want, but you'll lose on another side. And that's the real art, and that's something that Prabhupada was very, very expert at, is applying the principle in a practical way. Without offending either side. And he was so charming. He had charming shakti, that when devotees came on both sides with their, you know, pointing at each other, you're doing this, well, that's because you're doing this, he would cool everyone down. And by his presence, at least to some degree, his presence put him in the center. The power of his presence put him and pleasing him in the center. And he reminded everyone just by doing that. Yeah, did you want to add any more or comment any more?
Many things to say, but I accept the principle you were just...
Yeah, because I always find it's best, when, especially when you're giving a one's giving a temple Bhagavatam class, because I've seen it tens of times, people, you know, there's a particular tense issue going on in a temple. And people will ask the speaker who not sometimes not even aware of, you know, especially of the details of what's going on and who's on which side and everything, and they ask him to comment on these things, and he tends to end up going on one side or the other, and it causes so much problem, because then they, you know, the people use it to beat the other one on the other side, they beat him over the head with it, and that doesn't help things, because it just makes people further apart. So there's many things to say, certainly, and many things to be said to the right people at the right time in the right place. And I never find that the Bhagavatam classes are the right place for speaking principles. That's what I find. And again, it's wisdom. It's real wisdom to know how to judiciously apply a principle to the time and place. And when you read about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, what he considered, for instance, the judicious application of principles and things that Prabhupada did, some of the things that he did, appear very radical, because that's what was required. So one has to have really, before one does something really radical, and the word radical literally means it cuts it to the root, like mul and muli. It's a root vegetable. So you have to be really careful when you're going to make a radical decision and cut something to the root, that you really have vision of how it's going to affect the whole plant. And that type of deep wisdom and intelligence is required. Because we mentioned in yesterday's class something that comes up to my mind, is that Krishna is the only one who knows everything. His consciousness, it came up in something that was spoken by Lord Shiva, that he knows everything. And myself, knowing my consciousness has a small piece of reality, and I see that, the small piece of my reality, I see that with the conviction that it is reality itself. And to see the part as the whole is illusion. And that's my pride. And I'm so convinced when I think something's right, I'm so convinced. And when I think something's wrong, I'm so convinced. And when I'm already convinced, I don't hear anyone. And then, of course, maybe 2 years later or 2 weeks later or even 2 minutes later, my mind completely, you know, I see something else and my mind changes or I have a different experience. And so, what to do? And yet we have to proceed forward with what we have. So with a humble heart, we make our suggestions to the... make our offerings, make our suggestions as offerings. And the real difficulty I find is that when the excesses on one side have caused so much pain and difficulties, and therefore there is a tendency, I find, to react very strongly to those things. But the reactions that I make may cause difficulty on another side. So still we should proceed with great respect and humility and making sure the center is in our own consciousness is proper. Okay, the end. Srila Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srila Prabhupada service ki jai, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur ki jai.